We're going to call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is Wednesday, March 6th, 2013. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Johnson moves the minutes. Any errors, omissions, or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, members, we have a very long agenda with some things that people feel pretty passionate about. And so if you all don't mind, my vice chair is not here, I'm just going to start. I'm going to chair the meeting, and even though my bill's on the agenda, I'd just like to get started if there's no objections. All right. So with that, I move that House File 157 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. So, members, this is my bill. It's related to the regulation of bullion coin dealers, and this is my testifier, so if you want to go ahead and state the name for the record. Actually, we do have an amendment that I'd like to put on the bill to get the bill in the shape that I would like it. So the chair moves the 157DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Benjamin Velzlin. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to the problem of fraudulent coin dealers in Minnesota. These fraudulent coin dealers often target senior citizens, and I have personally spoken with senior citizens who have lost thousands of dollars
I'm going to interrupt you for just 1 second. Those of you in the back, I can hear you. So if you could keep it down back there. Go ahead.
I'm going to say, I have personally spoken with senior citizens who have lost thousands of dollars as a result of fraudulent coin transactions with dealers based in Minnesota. These coin dealers and those they employ often have lengthy criminal histories. They market coins to senior citizens many times as investments, but then oftentimes fail to either provide the coins that the senior citizen has paid for, or if the senior citizen is selling the coins, pay them the money that is owed to them. The office has received a number of complaints over the years about fraudulent coin dealers based in Minnesota, including many complaints from senior citizens like the following two. In 2012, an 80-year-old man received an unsolicited phone call from a coin dealer based in Minnesota who convinced him to pay almost $12,000 for gold coins. After the coin dealer electronically withdrew the funds from the senior citizen's bank account, it never delivered the coins to him. In May 2012, an 82-year-old woman received an unsolicited call from a coin dealer as well. The coin dealer similarly convinced her to pay about $12,000 for 10 gold coins. 2 days later, the woman was admitted to the hospital and then later a nursing home. Like the earlier coin dealer I mentioned, this coin dealer also never provided her with the gold coins she had paid for. As I referenced earlier, coin dealers often market these coins to senior citizens and others as investments or investment opportunities. Unlike, for example, the securities industry, the insurance industry, however, gold coin dealers and the coin industry is largely unregulated. Our office has brought 4 lawsuits against coin dealers based in Minnesota over the last several years in an attempt to police the area. And in addition to that, federal authorities have also brought criminal charges against coin dealers based in Minnesota. And an individual named David Marion actually pled guilty to federal criminal charges about 2 weeks ago in federal court. So that's the scope of the problem in Minnesota. The bill you have before you addresses that problem in several ways. It requires coin dealers and their agents to register with the Department of Commerce, go through a screening process to try to weed out bad actors, and post a surety bond. It prohibits persons convicted of certain crimes, such as fraud, theft, and financial crimes, from working in the industry. It requires that coin dealers actually provide the coins they sell to consumers or remit to them the money owed to them if the consumer sells coins to the coin dealer. It also prohibits a variety of misrepresentations and other unscrupulous business tactics that we have seen present in the coin industry through our investigations and enforcement actions. I also want to briefly highlight that the bill attempts to focus narrowly on the problems we have observed in the industry. It does that by limiting its scope and carving out some exceptions in a couple of ways. For one, it only applies to coins. It does not apply to jewelry, necklaces, or other precious metal products. It only applies if the coin dealer is engaged in $5,000 or more in coin transactions during the preceding 12 months. It also excludes from its coverage casual coin sales at garage sales, yard sales, and the like. It excludes securities brokers from its coverage, as those are regulated elsewhere in Minnesota law. It excludes wholesale transactions from its coverage, so if a coin dealer is selling coins to another coin dealer and not at retail. And it also excludes auctioneers from its coverage, as they're just selling coins on behalf of another. Lastly, I'd just like to also note that the bill has broad support. The Department of Commerce supports the bill, the AARP supports the bill, and the Minnesota Better Business Bureau also supports this bill. We have also been working and continue to work with members of the industry who have similarly been supportive of our efforts to prevent and deter fraud in the coin industry in Minnesota. So with that, I'd be certainly happy to take any questions from
you. Questions from members? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Okay, members, we have been trying to check with Representative Paymar. He is on this committee, but not in the room yet, on whether or not his committee needed to hear this bill. So it would be my intention to send it to the General Register and then pull it back to his committee if he would like to see it. So with that, the chair renews her motion that House File 157 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register as amended. All those in... Oh, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did hear this bill earlier, but I haven't had a chance to look over the DE amendment. I'm just trying to understand the criminal violation on the bottom of page 8 and what that means. Could somebody describe to me what happens? Maybe the testifier can.
Certainly. Mr. Belzin, is that how I say it?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative, just so I know what you're looking at, are you looking at section 9 of the bill?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Belzin, go ahead.
That section renders it a misdemeanor to violate two particular provisions of the bill that require the coin dealer to either simply provide the consumer the coins they paid for or remit to them the money that they're owed for selling coins. It does not cover other sections of the bill. So it's just those situations where there's been a non-delivery of coins or a non-payment of monies that is owed to the consumer that would render it a misdemeanor.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It does not apply to Section 7 of the bill, which I was wondering about. What are the consequences for not complying with Section 7 of the bill for someone?
Mr. Belzin.
Madam Chair, Representative. Just to confirm, you're correct. It only applies to the two subparts of Section 7, 2 and 3, which are the non-delivery and the non-payments parts. The other parts of Section 7, this bill provides Commerce with general enforcement authority through Section 45.027, and it would also allow for enforcement by the Attorney General. It renders violations of the other parts of Section 7 consumer fraud.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, I'm sorry, it's been a long day. Back to Section 9, so on line 8.29, it says, without having first registered with the commissioner, how does that qualifier affect? Okay, so if they haven't registered and they're engaged in the business, it's a misdemeanor. That's what that says.
Mr. Belzin.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Further questions?
Wow, so I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no further questions, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next item on the agenda is House File 290, Representative Simon. Representative Simon, the chair moves that House File 290 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Simon, I believe there are some amendments. So, Representative Simon, are one of these amendments yours?
Yes, Madam Chair. A1 is mine.
Okay. Representative Simon, the chair moves the 290A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simon, have you had the opportunity to review the A2 amendment?
I have, Madam Chair. I believe that was your amendment.
It was, Your Honor. It was Representative Simon.
And, Madam Chair, I have with me, and she can discuss it now or later, Ms. Bridget Dowdell from the Department of Human Services, who's been working with the feds in Washington about what language would work in terms of compliance. And I think having reviewed it, she can speak for herself, but I think her review of it, her conclusion was it's fine.
Okay. So the chair then would move the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon. Please go ahead.
Thank you, members. I appreciate it. I know you're pressed for time. You have a lot of other bills. This is a modernization of the False Claims Act. And some of you who were around a few years ago remember, we passed this on a bipartisan basis in 2009. Governor Pawlenty signed it into law. Basically, the False Claims Act started during the Civil War. It was called Lincoln's Law originally. It was a way for the federal government to get at crooked contractors who sold, you know, lame mules and rotten food to the Union Army, and there had to be some way to get at these contractors who intentionally did so. And over time, it sort of morphed into a major kind of anti-fraud piece of legislation where the federal government first, and now the states, could go after those who, again, knowingly defraud the taxpayers in that way. And it's only knowing conduct. It's not negligently or accidentally or inadvertently. It's only those who knowingly do so, as by intentionally or knowingly overbilling or other sort of conduct. So we passed this on a bipartisan basis. And one of the what Congress did, by the way, in the mid-1980s, and one of the reasons why we did this, and I think we were the 23rd state to do it, I think a few more have joined since then, is Congress saw that the ability of these False Claims Act was so effective in getting at fraud because it incentivizes whistleblowers to report this fraud, that it determined that, hey, we might as well do this and incentivize states to pass their own False Claims Acts when it comes to jointly administered federal-state programs. And the biggest one, of course, that we all deal with is Medicaid, or as we call it in Minnesota, Medical Assistance, or MA. And so MA is a 50-50 program, 50% feds, 50% state. And that means that when monies are recovered due to Medicaid fraud, which is kind of a big deal and happens more than we'd all like it to, that money is also distributed on a 50-50 basis. So if a federal prosecutor brings in money due to Medicaid fraud, Minnesota gets half of that. Likewise, if a state prosecutor or attorney, either civilly or criminally, brings in that money, well, we have to cough up half to the feds. So it works out both ways. Whoever does the work has to split it 50-50. What the feds said in the mid-80s is, hey, states, if you pass a False Claims Act that meets certain requirements in terms of being aggressive and strong and restrictive, if you do that, we're going to give you a 10% bonus, meaning that from now on, instead of a 50-50 split, we'll do a 60-40 split, 60 in favor of Minnesota. So I handed out on the yellow sheet here kind of a real-world example. We had this in civil law as well, members. But in case you're wondering, well, why do we care whether we get this extra bump, you can see in just one case, this was a national case, a large national drugstore chain, there was a False Claims Act settlement. And Minnesota's portion of that was roughly $2.4 million. And you can read for yourself where it says net gain. Were we to qualify for the federal bump or the federal bonus, this is how much in each of the three situations we would get extra than what we already got. So under a triple damages situation, we get $727,000. So on the green sheet is a letter that we got in August 31st, 2011. And it went to the Attorney General's office. It went to others in Minnesota saying, you guys passed a False Claims Act. It's great, but here are the ways in which it's deficient, and we can't give you the bump or the bonus unless you do these things in the letter. So all I did was took the letter, went over to House Research, and said nothing more or nothing less. Please draft some amendments that would put us in compliance so that we can get the extra money. It's not money that would otherwise be spent or anything like that. It would just go to the federal government rather than us, and we deserve it. So all I did was go to House Research and went to a couple House researchers who I trust and said, just draft a bill that does this. That's what you have before you. The amendment that I just put on, which maybe Ms. Dowdell can comment on, came from a phone call that she and some of her colleagues had, a couple of weeks ago or so with them, where since this letter came out, and now it's a year and a half old, they said there were a couple of extra things they wanted us to add. And maybe she can comment about that. They're largely technical. But other than that, that's what the bill does. It would make sure that we qualify for that bonus, that bump. That's the whole bill. It's technical in nature.
Representative Simon, is it something that your testifier needs to testify to, or is she just here for questions?
She's here for questions.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dowdle just alerted me to something. When the A2 amendment went on, there's arguably some redundant language that was covered in A1, and I don't know if this is the place necessarily and how to clean it up. I mean, it's truly a technical cleanup. Ms. Dowdle, do you want to identify yourself in that?
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bridget Dowdle, on behalf of the Department of Human Services members. That's correct. It looks like, in light of your amendment, Amendment 2, there's language that you both address the same issue, and so I would think that in Amendment 1, if lines 1.7 and 1.8 of Amendment 1 were stricken, the language in Amendment 2 incorporates that, and it tracks the federal language. Amendment 2 tracks the federal language almost verbatim, and so if in Amendment 1, the lines 1.7 and 1.8 are stricken, I think that would resolve the issue. The other parts of Amendment 1 are different than what's offered in Amendment 2 and do need to be added.
Ms. Perius, if you could clarify that with the members, do you understand that there were two amendments that changed the exact same place? And so staff wants to do a technical language, a technical cleanup to make certain that they're not inconsistent. So does anyone have an objection to an oral amendment to clean up the technical issue that arose by adopting two amendments? All right, Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment would be to the A1 amendment. It's coded H0290A1, and it would be to delete page 1, lines 7 and 8.
Page 6? Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair and members, this would be an amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
And then it wouldn't be incorporated into the document.
Questions from members? And Representative Simon, that is what you'd like us to do?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, Representative Simon, the chair. Representative Simon, the question that we need clarification is, at this point, is anyone declaring a cost to this bill? Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, no. No.
So there is no fiscal note for anyone. It doesn't need to go anywhere else.
That's correct. That's my understanding, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 290, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon. All right, Representative Simon, do you want to briefly take your next bill? How long do you think your testifiers will take, Representative Simon, for timing purposes?
Not very long.
Representative Simon?
I really, Madam Chair, really only have the one, and he's a practitioner in this area, and so that's really it. A few minutes, I don't know. I know you have a long agenda, and I appreciate the time.
So, Representative Simon, if I allocate 5 minutes for your time, is that okay?
I think we can do that.
All right. And I know that there are a few others that would like to speak. I had four on the agenda, but it's my understanding that two are not here. So is it my understanding that there are two testifiers in opposition at this point? Raise your hand if you want to testify. So there are two in opposition. If I give you 5 to 10 minutes, is that enough time? Okay. So, Representative Simon, it's my intention to vote on this bill by 5 minutes to 3. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 291 has to do with some modernization of our assisted reproduction rules and guidelines. I want to make very clear from the outside, you are not being asked today. I'm not asking you. No one's asking you to vote yay or nay or make a decision about whether you approve of or disapprove of assisted reproduction, if you think it's good or bad. I happen to think, we already have it. It's going on. These arrangements are being done every day. I have a cousin who has 2 children by assisted reproduction. But that's okay. You're not being asked to decide that. And some of you may have your own reasons why you have questions about this. But it's legal, it's happening, and we might as well have some guardrails in place. So the bill brief from House Research is excellent. I mean, it basically talks about determinations of maternity and paternity, and the bottom line is it gives all the parties to an assisted reproduction arrangement a day in court. It merely gives them standing. It doesn't mean anyone's going to win. It doesn't put a thumb on the scale in favor of any one party. It merely acknowledges the existence of these agreements and says that everyone gets their day in court to make certain arguments. That really is the bill, and I'd like to turn it over, if I could, to someone who practices in this area and brought it to the attention, this issue to the attention of Minnesota State Bar Association, which endorses this, and others as well. Steve Snyder.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Stephen H. Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, Madam Chair. I am the current chair of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee, and I work with attorneys all over the country that practice in this area. Therefore, I'm aware of the various court cases that have arisen and the problems with the disconnect between the current state of the law and the current state of medicine. As Representative Simon said, this is not a bill for or against surrogacy as a process. It is a procedural bill to even the playing field of our current legislative statutes governing this area. In the courts, due process is a standard which is adhered to so that everybody with an interest in a piece of litigation has the opportunity to appear and be heard. And if due process is violated, the resulting judgments are subject to attack based on constitutional principles. In surrogacy, the interested persons include anyone who has an interest in asserting parentage over the resulting child. Under our current statute, that includes the woman who gives birth and her husband, if any. So the surrogate has a right to go into court and say, I don't want to give up this child, I want to parent this child, and so does her husband. The other presumption that's currently in effect is a genetic presumption. So the person who provides the sperm and the egg also have the right to go into court and say, we would like the court to establish parentage in us. In a surrogacy arrangement, that is the case in maybe 60% of the cases. However, the other 40%, the woman not only lacks the uterus to carry, she lacks the capacity to generate the egg, perhaps because she's had a complete hysterectomy. So her husband provides the sperm, and she must substitute for her egg an egg donor's egg. That means she is not the birth mother and she's not a genetic mother, but she's part of the couple who are trying to procreate through this process. And because it is her motivation and desire to be a parent that initiated the process, because it's her and her husband's resources that pay for the procedures, and because it's her dream to become the parent of this child who is genetically related to her husband, she certainly has an interest in the outcome and should have the right to appear in court and say, please consider me as a possible parent and consider my arguments in determining who the parent should be. All this bill does is correct the gap created by the disconnect between law and medicine that this woman with a distinct interest in the proceedings also has standing to appear and have her interests considered by the court. So I'll end with a real life example. I currently have in my office a case in which a woman and her husband had been trying for 9 years to become parents. Eventually, the fertility physician said, you need to use a surrogate and you need to use an egg donor. Her husband provided the sperm. They became pregnant with a surrogate. On the Friday that the surrogate called and said, you're pregnant, I'm carrying your child, aren't you thrilled? The next day she walked in the kitchen and her husband was dead on the floor. So what currently exists is that a friend of that family that's carrying twins for that woman is dealing with a woman who has no standing to appear in court and assert any parental rights. It's a gap in the standing issue because she's not the egg donor and she's not the birth mother. So at this point in time, there is no capacity under the law for her to appear in a parentage proceeding and assert maternity. And this bill would fix that problem. It gives the surrogate equal rights to appear, and it keeps the same standard that has been in place since the Parentage Acts were put in place, the best interests of the child. So all it means is that the court has all the parties that are interested before it and can make a decision based on the best interests of the child as to who would be the most desirable and fit parent. It's a fact function of due process and standing. It does not affirm or negate surrogacy in any way, shape, or form.
Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me what happens now, given the fact we don't have this this language in law? What's the default? What happens? Does a surrogate usually pursue parentage for the child, and then later is there an adoption or something? What happens now?
Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, at this point in time, let me clarify something. Out of 15,000 reported surrogacies nationwide, there have been 89 that have entered into any contest. 62 of those were intended parents who didn't want the children because they were handicapped, or they got divorced, or they went bankrupt, or some problem occurred on their side. Only 27 were surrogates who purported to desire to keep the child. That's less than 0.5%. So these are very reliable relationships that do not break down. They break down at a magnificently far lower rate than adoptions. So the current situation is that if a surrogate wants to change her mind, and in this situation the mother has not provided the egg, the surrogate will prevail automatically under the current presumption. The intended mother has no standing to change that. And because it is her motivation to become a parent and her husband's genetic material, we firmly believe that to balance the statute, that needs to be changed.
Members, we actually have a bunch of people that want to testify, or a few people that want to testify in opposition. I'd like to give them the opportunity to speak, and then we'll come back to questions. Thank you. Those of you that want to testify in opposition, I believe we have Tom Pritchard, and is it Greg Troy that wants to come as well? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 291. While this appears to be a simple bill on its face, it is really a very significant and far-reaching bill. This bill will, for the first time to my knowledge, give legal effect to surrogacy agreements in Minnesota. It is a backdoor, major first step toward giving full legal recognition to written surrogacy agreements. Under Minnesota law, for good reason, the birth mother is the mother of the child and has the right to custody of her child. This bill would change that. Under this bill, any adult or group of adults, you could have five adults under the language of this bill, who enter an agreement with a surrogate, would have legal standing to challenge the long-standing understanding that the birth mother of the child is the child's mother. In addition, under this bill, the male in a written agreement is presumed to be the father of the child. Under this bill, there is no expectation that the intended parents be biologically related to the child, that the couple be infertile, that the intended parents be fit. There's no guardian ad litem looking out for the interests of the child. If there's an agreement, then the signer of the contract has legal standing to sue for custody of the child. With no biological link to the child, they could go into court and demand custody of a biologically related child to the surrogate mother. It's estimated one survey found that 75% of surrogate mothers lose their babies in the custody battles. All this begs the question whether we should give surrogacy agreements legal recognition in our state. This is the fundamental question this bill raises, because the language of this bill takes a major step in this direction. I believe the birth mother is the mother of the child to prevent a wide range of abuses which invariably accompany these surrogacy agreements. First, such agreements are highly exploitive. They generally prey on vulnerable, single, low-income women who are the targets of surrogacy brokers, promising them $25,000, $50,000, and more in some cases. They basically seek to encourage these women to sign away their constitutional rights as the mother of the child for whom they give birth. In this instance, a poor mother will be forced to defend her right to be the mother against a conceivably wealthy person or couple under a surrogacy agreement. Second, these agreements create a class of women who bear children for compensation. women who use their physical ability to bear a child for money, pure and simple. Whether this occurs in Minnesota or India, it's a highly exploitive process. Surrogacy is exploitation of women for reproductive purposes. Third, these surrogacy agreements are highly exploitive of children. In this case, children who are the result of a written agreement. Pure children are treated as commodities. They are created, designed based on the desires of an adult or a couple of adults who hire a woman to bear a child, and then upon demand, demand the child be turned over for cash. This is baby selling, pure and simple. This bill would give legal standing to an agreement party simply because they signed an agreement. There are absolutely no protections in the bill, which you find in the area of adoption. Background checks, are they suitable parents? Can they support the child? Do they have a criminal record, etc.? Are these agreements in the child's best interest? I would argue no. This bill does an end run around this question by assuming they are and then deciding between the parties to the contract who will be given custody. They basically turn over to the courts the decision whether the birth mother can keep the child she's carried for 9 months. At its core, this bill advances the cause of commodification of children. It's baby selling, pure and simple. This bill is a major step in gaining full legal recognition of surrogacy agreements in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Pritchard. You. Next, we have Greg Troy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gregory Troy. I'm a licensed attorney in the state of Minnesota practicing in the area of adoptions. And the past 25 years, I've watched this body create laws that have pursued the best interest of the child. This bill does not do that. Now, while Mr. Schneider, as a practicing attorney, may put many of those adoption provisions in his agreements, those are currently not what's before you. What's before you is an expansion of a largely unregulated industry, and it's both a legal industry and the IVF community that needs some tailoring. And I'm going to suggest to you that under Minnesota Statute 259, you already have the best interest of the child that's been carefully worked into Minnesota law and is available for you to work with. In prior years, when I've testified against this bill, we've had many attempts to do that. Now we've done away with it, and all you have before you is birth moms who are called surrogates who do not have any guarantee of legal representation or counseling prior to entering into these contracts. So right now you've got a void on the front end of who's entering into these contracts, and you don't have any information before you on what's going on in terms of the volume of IVF implantations taking place. One of the things that's clear in all of these contracts is that there are multiple implantations per surrogate. And as a result of these contracts, women are required to come back in and have what's called selective reduction or abortions. And you have no statistics before you on how many abortions are being done in IVF clinics. The other side of this that's missing is there's no fiscal note. And the fiscal note is going to directly relate to the rocket sky cost of health care, because you're going to have a largely undefined infertile community proceeding to define themselves as eligible for these procedures. So while the fact pattern that was raised in the instance of Mr. Schneider's client, I could change the fact pattern and say it's an 80-year-old woman whose 81-year-old husband died on the floor, and there's nothing restricting those arrangements. And again, it comes back to what's in the best interest of the child. There are no home studies. There is no background checks. You have no definition of who's eligible or ineligible. And if you follow Minnesota Statute 259, you'd have analogies to adoption agencies that are regulated by the Department of Human Services. They're required to go through follow-up visits and maintain their licensure, and they have to maintain a nonprofit status. We don't have any of that in place in Minnesota for IVF clinics or these procedures.
All right. If you could wrap up.
I'll wrap it up. Thank you, Madam Chair. The case in California is one case that everybody's familiar with, the Nadia Suleiman Octomom case, in which the birth mom comes to term with eight children, and you've got the welfare of the citizens of that state caring for those children, and the novelty will wear off, and she won't have the benefit of all of the book deals and movie deals to cover the cost of these children. And I would suggest you've got to get ahead of this and follow up with a comprehensive analysis that ties back to Minnesota Statute 259.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's more of a question or a comment, but it just seems to me that there should be more of guardrails on these agreements. And in civil law, we heard testimony from two surrogate mothers, and it was kind of heart-wrenching testimony, to be quite honest. And I'm sorry neither one of them are here today, because I think that gives a full view of what this issue really boils down to, rather than just having two attorneys talk about it. But I would just encourage the author to not have an all-or-nothing kind of a bill, but to work with, you know, over time, both sides of this issue, so that, you know, infertile couples, they want to have children, and I understand that. But at the same time, I don't know that there just aren't enough guardrails in place right now to prevent the adverse from happening. So appreciate it.
Further questions from members? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was also in civil law and heard the testimony from the two young women, and the only thing that I would add to what Representative Scott said is that these women ended up feeling just really devastated. If I'm not mistaken, one of them is in a position where she's paying child support now. I could be wrong about that. But having had no idea how she would feel after she gave birth to this child, and so entering into it, she just, young woman, had gave no consideration to how she would feel, and that was all different. So, which leads up to my question, and I think this question could be for either Representative Simon or our primary testifier. Wondering how many states request or assume the presumption of the first right of refusal, or I don't know what to officially call it, of the birth mother.
Representative Simon or Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, at this point in time, states regulate or react to surrogacy either by statute or case law. And right now there are approximately 12 states that have some restriction or prohibition on surrogacy, and there are approximately the same number who facilitate or officially approve of surrogacy. So that sets up about 24 out of the 52 jurisdictions that have some regulation. The rest are like Minnesota. We have no regulation at all. The only case we've had in Minnesota was a case in which a surrogate litigated with the intended father, who was the genetic father, and she was not the genetic mother. And in that case, which went to our intermediate appellate court, the court held that these agreements are not void as against public policy and granted sole custody to the intended father.
All right. Members, at this point, the chair would renew her motion. Oh, Representative Druskowski, briefly.
First of all, I'd like to ask for a roll call, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Representative Druskowski asks for a roll call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just curious. From what I heard in the testimony, it sounds like this would actually has a potential to increase this, you know, designer children contract process that seems to be the subject of the bill. Is that right?
Madam Chair.
Representative Simon, remember this is the Judiciary Committee. We're not in health. We're not in civil law. Right. We're Representative Simon.
Exactly. This is just about, that's why I focused on standing in the courts. That's
right.
It. We're not discussing, and even in civil law, as you recall, I said that we shouldn't, you know, people are going to have their individual opinions about whether it's baby selling or designer kids. That would be news to my cousin Jill, who has two wonderful little daughters. But look, people are going to have their own opinions on this. This is just about standing, who can open up the courthouse door and make an argument. And in the case of the 81-year-old who found her husband on the floor, I would bet my next paycheck, even if she had standing, she would lose, because it would probably not be in the best interest of the child to place her a child with her. This is all about standing, who gets to open up the courthouse door, not who wins. That's it.
Madam Chair. I was just going to respond to Representative Drzikowski's question.
Not at this point. You had your opportunity to testify, and we're not going to talk about things that are not within the judiciary here. So I've already gone, you know, past the time that I said we were going to vote. I asked before we started if folks thought that was enough time. So do members have other questions prior to asking for the roll call vote? All right. With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 291 be recommended to pass as amended. Is it amended? As amended and sent to the General Register. It's not amended. Not amended. House File 291 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. The clerk will call the roll.
Hillstrom?
Aye.
Moline?
Aye.
Vestkowski?
No.
Bly?
Yes.
Cornish?
No.
Portman?
Aye.
Johnson B?
No.
Johnson S?
Yes.
Lesh?
Aye.
Lean?
Aye.
McNamar?
Yes.
O'Neill?
No.
Paymar?
Aye.
Hugh?
No.
Scott?
No.
With 9 in favor and 6 opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Atkins, you're next on the agenda. Welcome to the committee. You have two bills, so which would you like to take up first, Representative Atkins?
How about 450, please, Madam Chair?
450. Is it someone else want to move the bill, or I can move the bill? Representative Portman. Moves that House File 450 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Atkins, how many testifiers do you have? How long do you think it'll take?
I have 5 minutes, and I'll turn it over to him.
Okay. And of those that are in the audience, how many of you wish to testify in opposition to this bill? I'm trying to get a sense for time. So no one?
Right.
Okay. Great. Representative Atkins, go ahead.
Madam Chair, we have one A1 amendment. If the chair or a member would be so kind as to move that for me, I'd appreciate it. It's an author's amendment that just clarifies a point that was made by staff and also affects the effective date.
All right. The chair would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Atkins, please keep your testimony to the area within the judiciary, if you could. Representative Atkins.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, and it is all within the judiciary, and since my testifier can present the information more quickly than I can, I'll turn it over to him immediately.
State your name for the record, and please go ahead.
My name is Eric Heiberg, and I'm an attorney at Healy Duncan Melander. I practice in construction law, and I'm here on behalf of the American Council of Engineer Companies. This bill is really quite simple. Minnesota has a statute of limitations and statute of repose on improvements to real property. That's been around since about 1965. In 2007, there was recognized a problem with the statute of repose in that certain causes of action were being barred by an unintended consequence of the statute of repose, so the legislature tried a fix. And in 2007, they passed a fix, and that fix opened up a door and it abrogated the statute of repose for certain types of causes of action, in particular called contribution and indemnity. And a contribution and indemnity is when one party gets sued and they say, well, wait a minute, we may have done something wrong, but they did something wrong too, and they should be in the case as well. And so what the legislature did is they took the statute of repose, which was 10 years or 12 years, depending on when the case was brought, and just said for contribution and indemnity clauses, we're going to say that there is no statute of repose. And that's led to some unintended consequences. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to close that hole so that there are not these unintended consequences. And the unintended consequences are really simple. Architects and engineers, when they stamp a drawing, are stamping it for life, and they're taking not only liability on behalf of their firm, but they're taking liability personally by stamping a drawing. And so by having no statute of repose for contribution indemnity, they have now opened up their personal liability on these projects forever. And that's caused some problems. First of all, it means that they can't retire, because once they retire, they can only buy insurance for 5 years with one 5-year renewal.
So all of a sudden, once they retire, have been retired for 10 years, they're no longer insured for things that they still have potential liability for. And second, firms are now required to retain all of their documentation on these projects forever. And that's got a huge burden and a huge cost. And so what we're trying to do is, instead of undoing the fix in 2007, we're proposing contribution indemnity claims be capped at 14 years. So the original one is 10 years. Then there's two more years to bring it's a 10-year statute of repose, and then we're saying the contribution indemnity are capped at 14 years, and then after that, those contribution indemnity clauses are ultimately barred. And the reason we're here is there's been some question on whether that would have any net impact on the judiciary, and our response is it shouldn't. In fact, if it did, it would go down a little bit. It's barring certain causes of action that are now available. The original cause of action will still be the same. The question is whether the motions for contribution and indemnity to bring in additional parties would be granted, and that would be the net effect on the judiciary. So we don't think it has any net effect.
Great. Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Hortman renews her motion that House Bill 450 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins, your second bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd appreciate it if House File 459 would be moved, and then the amendment is my A2 amendment, which is an author's amendment.
Representative Hortman moves that House File 459 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Commerce, and Representative Hortman moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will limit my comments solely to the piece that the Judiciary Committee would be concerned with, and that was there is a reference. This is regarding BPA legislation and what BPA can be allowed, what sort of products BPA can be allowed in. I know that piece of it isn't necessarily within the committee, but there's 325F, which is the statutory portion under which the penalty would occur, and that is a misdemeanor. We wanted to ensure that if somebody violated the provisions of this proposed law, that it was done knowingly. And so we've in the A2 amendment, we've got a number of clarifications that demonstrate that for there to be any penalty, that the individuals involved would actually have to knowingly cause BPA to be placed in a product. With that clarification, Madam Chair and members, I'd appreciate the body support.
And it's my understanding that at this point, this has no impact on our budget. So, questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who represents Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering how the agency is going to determine if someone knew where they were intentional about marketing these products to children under the age of 12.
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. That's an important question, and that was why we made the change in the bill. They would actually be held, and if you're going to charge somebody criminally, as folks in this committee know, you'd have to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, and it's a very high bar, but if you're going to impose a criminal penalty on somebody, you should be able to clear that high bar. So they'd have to collect evidence. They'd have to demonstrate either through emails or through written evidence or through testimony that somebody did, in fact, do it knowingly.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm thinking of a can of Campbell's soup, for instance, not necessarily marketed to a child. I eat Campbell's soup. So are they banned from manufacturing their soup with BPH in the can?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, in terms of what the amendment does, yes, it would have to be done knowingly. As far as the, if you want to get into the substance of the bill, I'm happy to visit about that as well.
Not here, Representative Atkins.
Well, this, Madam Chair, this does go directly to how they're going to prove intent. And so how do you prove that someone intended to me, to harm a child by putting this in there. They don't know that a child, whether a child's going to eat that can of soup or not.
And Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the body of law relative to establishing intent, and perhaps people like Representative Hillstrom and Representative Lesch who do criminal law might be able to attest to it better than somebody who does civil law. But the term knowingly is one that a prosecutor would have to be able to demonstrate through actual evidence. And that is through hard testimony, through witnesses that would say that, in fact, they ascertained that there would be potential harm, and they went forward anyway.
Representative Scott.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Adkins, who's going to be liable for this product that isn't the manufacturers, the grocer that puts it on the shelf?
Representative Adkins.
Thank you. And again, and with all due respect, I would read the bill. This is, as far as the knowing standard, that's what I came prepared to visit about. This would apply to a manufacturer who would knowingly offer for sale in the state a children's food container, and a retailer then that would knowingly sell or offer for sale by virtue of the amendment. So that would it would be those individuals that with intent offered for sale or manufactured this sort of product.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, how is the threshold set as to what is a prohibited chemical and what is a chemical designated as being that of high concern?
Madam Chair and Representative Lean, I apologize for not bringing those necessary experts, but the department has a standard that applies. I didn't anticipate, in the Judiciary Committee, but I can certainly put the right person in touch with you to give you the complete definition. But they literally have a definition that applies to which ones fall into those various categories.
Representative Lane.
Lane. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, I know you said there's no fiscal impact to the courts, but has this bill been heard in Commerce? Or what?
It's going there next.
Oh, okay. Because to me, there ought to be a fiscal note, because I think we have 6 canneries in this state. And if you go to doing this, prohibiting this chemical, you may likely put some of them out of business, which would be a huge impact to our state, I would think, if you go to doing that. And so I wish the people in Commerce well, because there's a lot of questions I have about this bill, but not necessarily in the purview of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Anyone else? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Hortman renews her motion that House File 459 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank
Representative
you,
Adkins,
Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Purcell, I'll move that House File 458 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Commerce. And I'll also move the A13 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want to say anything on your amendment?
This is just get it in the shape I want it.
Okay. All those in favor of adopting the A13 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author prefers, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Purcell, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me get my too many papers today. This bill is intended to remove to keep formaldehyde out of the ingredients in children's personal care products. And we're I don't want to read the bill here for you. I mean, it's not very long, but in the intent of doing that is that formaldehyde, while recognizing that it is a product in nature, it certainly is one that has a significant toxic and deleterious effects on human beings, and most of us remember that probably most poignantly in the Hurricane Katrina stuff, and the folks that got the FEMA trailers and got sicker than a dog from the panel board in those trailers. So, and that was formaldehyde that was doing that. So we know it's a hazard substance, and we know that we don't need to have it in these personal care products. And so this is just an effort to keep that out of the ingredients and protect kids.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. And if your first testifier could state his name and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen, representing the Healthy Legacy Coalition, who's working with Representative Purcell on this bill. I don't really have really a prepared comment. I believe this bill is here for the same reason that House File 459 was here, that noncompliance would be punishable by a misdemeanor.
Thank you. Is there anyone else to testify for or against the bill? Are there questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm trying to figure out, can you tell me any items that you're looking at here that are actually have formaldehyde in, other than things in the home like the carpet and the paneling? Well, that's not intended for be put on the child to begin with, but they're in the home. What kind of products are you talking about that have formaldehyde?
Representative Purcell.
I'm gonna dig for some paperwork here while I'm, and I thought we had a handout on that, but while I'm doing that, Mr. Andreessen, if you want to speak, that's fine too.
Go ahead.
Chair, Representative, there are several products currently on the shelf that have chemicals that degrade into formaldehyde, one of them being quaternium 15. It's currently being used in Johnson & Johnson's baby shampoo. They are looking to phase that out, but there are other products that do use that. And that's what this bill is intended to do, is to get that chemical out of the products.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, how long does it take for that to degrade to it? It's a matter of months, days, years, decades?
Madam Chair, Representative, it certainly kind of depends on how long it's been sitting on the shelf and what kind of environment it's being used under, but there's been plenty of studies showing that over time it does degrade into formaldehyde.
Are there any other questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Purcell, what is the penalty or the consequence of violating this law?
Representative Purcell.
It's a misdemeanor.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Purcell, I'm looking at page 2 of the bill. The way this is written, amount of precision, especially as we look at lines 2.4 and 2.5, seems to be very problematic. It says, on the basis of credible scientific evidence by a state, federal, or international agency as being known or suspected with a high degree of probability. So if a state agency suspects with a high degree of probability, which says nothing, what's a high degree of probability? That's very much a relative statement there that is very subjective. Mm-hmm. I find the language very problematic.
Let me take a shot at responding here, Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, and if I'm not good enough, I'll ask Mr. Andreessen to help me out here. But when agencies look at this is state, federal, international, and they look at toxicology studies, and that's what I would believe. I mean, this is what we're talking about. Is there science out there that speaks to the toxicity of the substance, the chemical? And when we talk about high degree of probability in science, I mean, you can't measure zero, right? And you can't measure many things with a 100% probability in science. It's just impossible to do that. So the language is intended to reflect that there's always some uncertainty, Representative Drazkowski, with everything we do. It's like flipping a coin. You flip it and flip it, flip it. You get heads, you get heads, you get heads, you get heads, and you say, it's got to be tails. Probability is 50%. It's going to be heads the next time, too, right?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Purcell, I still struggle even after that response. And, I relate to what you're talking about. But here, so if there's one scientific study that a state agency pulls out of some journal somewhere and says, this particular study says this, therefore, company X, you are now in a position because you are producing these products, you are now in a position to be charged with a crime. I mean, one scientific study, as I read it, it doesn't even talk about replication of studies or the credibility that that develops over that. So I struggle with the way the language is written.
Representative Johnson has a question.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, on line 2.4, you said have international agency. This I can understand the federal government. I can understand the state of Minnesota, but I don't think the UN, Iraqi University, or the Iraqi government, if they do a study, should tell us what we do in the state of Minnesota.
Can I respond to that?
Well, it wasn't a question, but Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't overdo this, but to both questions, if you will. And science is done by the preponderance of the evidence, and one study in some journal somewhere doesn't constitute preponderance of the evidence. So, it says credible scientific evidence. Credible scientific evidence isn't one study somewhere, Representative Drazkowski. Just not. That's just not the way science is done. And so believe me, it won't happen that way. Now, our state agency isn't going to do it. And let me go back to the Iraqi University or Representative Johnson's question. I don't know that we're going to get any credible scientific evidence out of those universities, but if there's science that's done, and it's done all the way around the world, and it's done to ASTM standards or other standards that we accept as in science, hypothesis testing, etc., that we all learned in our basic science classes in high school and college, then they can write it up. And if it's in a journal and it's repeated science, and that's how things gain credibility. It's not credible just because it's in a journal.
Representative Purcell, we do have other questions, but okay. I'd like to know at this point if there's anyone else from the public to testify here for or against the bill. No? Okay, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Purcell, in line 2.4, could you describe to me, I'm not a scientist, I'm not in a lab, what high degree of probability is? Is it 51%? Is it 65%? I mean, I don't know what that term means either.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Scott, I don't want to turn this into a science lesson, but if you get into it, you're going to be up in the 90s somewhere.
Okay. Thank you, other Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so these criteria that you have on the back here for the replacement chemical, were those the same criteria used to exclude formaldehyde?
Tell me where you're looking again.
On the back page, on page 2, all those criteria for the replacement chemical, were those the same criteria that were used for this ban that you're requesting on formaldehyde? In other words, was there credible scientific evidence by state, federal, or international agencies with a high degree of probability to harm, and et cetera?
Does that exist for formaldehyde, Representative Scott? Is that what you're...
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, did you use those same criteria to rule out the use of formaldehyde? Is that how you arrived at this ban for formaldehyde, as you went through and all these criteria were met, and that's why you're banning it?
Representative Purcell.
There is credible scientific evidence that formaldehyde is a toxic substance. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you have the bill there on page 2, did it meet the criteria of numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Representative Purcell.
I'm advised yes.
And Madam Chair, and to your testifier there, I'd like to see those studies, if I could, please.
I'm sure that can be arranged.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Purcell, I mean, you seem to have an idea of what you believe to be a high degree of probability. It's not defined here. There's not a definition for that for the court to interpret when we put this law in front of them. Credible scientific evidence. What is a court supposed to use in making that judgment on what credible scientific evidence is? Let's have a definition for it. Representative Purcell, this bill needs work.
Well, that again wasn't a question, but it looks like Representative Lesch has a possible answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, this is not for a court to decide. This is for a finder of fact to decide, meaning a jury. So you got to convince a jury that the facts in the case that they're deciding fits that definition. But before you even get there, you need to get a judge to accept the evidence on foundational basis as well. So there are several bars before you can even get to that. Some of this language may not even be necessary, but it just provides a framework to work with. Ultimately, you got to get a jury to believe it. So I think that provides the standard that you're looking for.
If I may, Madam Chair, real quick, there are standards, Representative Drazkowski, in place in the legal system for expert witness that cover science.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 458 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Commerce as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee.
Members, we need to move to reconsider House File 157 be passed and sent to the General Register. From my understanding, Representative Hillstrom would like to send it to another committee. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, members. I would ask that you would reconsider House File 157 that we sent to the General Register. Came back with a fiscal note in Commerce, and so we need to send it back to Commerce, even though it's already been there, to address the fiscal issue.
So all those in favor of reconsidering House File 157 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 157 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Commerce Committee.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. We are adjourned.